Hello, everyone out there listening on your mobile devices or your magical crystal ball, whatever suits you best. This is Niklas, and this is Mead and Moonlight, and I'm here again another week with my lovely co-host, which is, of course, Kuhn. Kuhn, say hello.
Hello. I don't know. I always get sort of hyped up when you're like, oh, lovely co-host. I'm all about keeping it real. This is the second take, and I was going to say the same awesome thing about wizards using their time to listen to us through crystal balls, and how I would invest my time completely different if I was able to Wingardium Leviosa the shit out of things. But if people from wizardry schools are actually listening, hello, we are very happy to have you as well, because mudbloods, wizards, humans, it's all the same to us. Welcome. Still happy to be here with this amazing podcast, and I'm excited to be talking about what we are going to be talking about. I'm so eloquent. This is actually even better than the first one. How are you doing, Niklas, sir?
I'm just doing great, like every time that we talk. I'm a bit sad that you sort of broke the magic of the show business by just admitting that this is the second try, the second take. But, you know, okay, I guess we can break the fourth wall a bit, you know. So, yeah. Well, as you mentioned, we are sort of continuing the topic that we talked about last episode, which was, you know, very roughly like the creative process and sort of like writing songs and how we might approach it. Not a very technical episode, but that probably wouldn't have been really interesting anyway to most people. So the logical follow-up to that episode is the episode we're going to do now, which is all about recording, either, you know, be that at home or in a studio, and all of our experiences with that, and how we've fared so far in that aspect of making music. So, Kuhn, let's just start straight away. I think you've probably had a couple different studio experiences, so had I. Can you remember the first time you sort of stepped a foot into like a real recording studio?
I think we've been through quite the roller coaster, and I think we have sort of brushed over the old the famous stories from older metal bands that have now grown out to be one of the greatest by starting out as a garage studio band. Because I remember that the first little demo we recorded was where my mother, she is a physical therapist, but then not really with children that have problems concentrating, like ADHD and stuff. So we sort of recorded our album there with one mic, with one bit of software, and three musicians that thought they were the shit. Someone that had some experience with like Logic Pro. I think that's the Apple recording software. And so we created the demo out of that. And then, obviously, looking back on it, technically, it wasn't very great. The second step, we were like, no, man, we can do better. Oh, my God, who records it like that? But we are a pagan folk band inspired by fairies, are we not? If we sing about the forest and fairies and woodland critters, let's take the studio into the forest. Same experience. We invested some money into equipment, and we rigged a wire from a local cafe in Belgium all the way into a forest. set up a studio over there without any like real producer knowledge. I mean, there's an education attached to being a producer, please respect that. Which we didn't, and we created our first album, Portrait of Elfland, and it was great. It was an adventure. People enjoy it still, but if you look at it at a technical level, there's a lot to be said about it, and there's been a lot that has been said about it, and who can blame them? But we had a great adventure at the time, and I think it can't get any more pagan folk naturey than that. The next step, obviously, when we had accumulated some revenue from our gigs at various festivals, we took it to a real studio, there's a lot to be said about that. There's also still a lot to be said about the other, I don't know, some people call it missteps, I call it happy little accidents, about our previous albums. Before I delve into like the real dealio, like Through the Veil, our album, and going from there, we're in the middle of recording the next one, I'm curious if you have similar garage band experiences with trying to maybe capture like the pagan folk indie album, or having a lack of funds, which is not definitely not specific to this scene. It's I think a lot of musicians from all over the world can sort of get into that. Niklas, do you have any garage band tales or otherwise organic growth stories about your recording adventures?
Well, that your answer got a lot more detailed than I expected it to be, but okay, I'm gonna try and also sort of like give an overview of my experience so far with recording. At this point, Vatkots has sort of like three releases, I guess. There is one demo, and then there's two albums. I wasn't a part of the demo recording, like the first, I think it was four songs on there, or five maybe, I don't know. Me and Nina, we weren't in the band at that point. It was just the three of them. And so I can't really, and I think that, however, was like recorded in a very DIY way in their old rehearsal space, which I think was just the cellar of the parents of our drummer and our former hurdy-gurdy and harp player. And they even then, I think our former guitar player and our drummer are both very like interested in like the technical aspect of making music. So with limited resources they had, they tried to make it very professional, and they had like one room was a dedicated recording space, so it would just be like a microphone or like several microphones and the musician, and then there was a closed door which they just laid some cables under, and that was the control room where like the mixing desk was, and so that you had as little, you know, interference in the room as you could. And I remember there's like an anecdote where our former guitar player and percussionist sort of like played a prank on our drummer who was recording, and they were recording djembe, and then they set up everything real nice and it sounded really good, and then our guitar player just exchanged the djembe for just like a carton, a box. And then our drummer was very confused because suddenly it sounded very different. And then he turned all like the different knobs and like preamps and tried everything. And then in the end, he had like he made it sound very nicely. But the problem is, which it wasn't like the proper drum. He had just made like a box, a paper box sound very nice. So when he heard our guitar player laughing, and he went checking, and he saw that he had just exchanged the drum, the djembe, for a cart, like a box. And that is sort of, I think, an anecdote that is still fondly remembered by those who remember it. And then for the first album, we actually went in a professional recording studio, but the thing is that we really could only, like, for time issues, we could only really go into a studio that was sort of close by, so we hadn't really a lot to pick from. And the one we ended up in, it was very, we were all very inexperienced with, you know, with recording music at that point, so we had to be able to rely on the engineer. And that, unfortunately, he wasn't really, he hadn't any prior experience with, like, recording folk instruments, or, like, let alone, like, well, he didn't know what pagan folk was. So we sort of got in there, and at that point, I think me and Nina, we only were in the band for, like, half year maybe before we recorded the first album, and it was all very simple and basic. Lots of people still very much like the album, but to my ears, it has lots of you know, maybe like wasted potential. And then because the guy, the studio engineer, was sort of in the same time that he was working on our album, he was working like on a soundtrack for a movie that he had made. So we always felt that his heart wasn't really in it. And in the end, we had to call in some friends and then mixed and mastered the album at home, because we were so unhappy with everything that he did. So that was sort of a bad experience. And then for the second album, we recorded it at a, you know, better studio, and we took like a long, long time, way longer than we should have had. So we, yeah. And then I guess we're still sort of happy with that recording, but, you know, the more you progress as a band, the more you realize that there's things that you would now, of course, do differently than you would have back then. So, and yeah, now we had a studio session lined up with what I think would have been the perfect candidate to record with, but, you know, that's still postponed. We hope it's gonna happen in September now, but, you know, you never know with how things develop, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed. So yeah, that was a short sort of summary, I guess.
I like, I respect your cardboard box or your box story. And on the same time, it brushes on a subject that sort of scares me, is how you can make anything sound really good. But there's, I think there's like two aspects to that. By the way, I'm really thrilled to hear that, and I'm very curious about other band stories that you've also gone through, like the whole development of starting out. Like, we're going to DIY it, you know? I mean, let's record an album. Let's just do it. How hard can it be? And then, like you also described, and I think there's many more people, and of course it gets easier now to get equipment that actually makes it sound decent. But that you're like, oh damn man, these songs were great, but we just had no way or had no clue what was needed to translate those. Basically the live feel, the feel that you get with those songs, especially in like an acoustic genre, I think, like this, how can we translate this to a digital CD? I'm going to give a random percentage. You're only 50% part of the product. Maybe even less if, like, the producer really tries to wreck your product. He can. He or she can. That's not a problem. So it's actually, it's interesting to see. And it brings back memories, you know. It's like, oh, God, this could have been. And at some point, with some albums, some artists from whichever genre, was like, oh God, they're doing a remastered or they're doing a best of, they're re-recording their songs. I get it now. They're like, this song was great, but it didn't get the proper translation. And I think with this genre, it's why we are dedicating an episode of this podcast to this, and also very interested in future episodes when we're sitting around the table with bands, when we can again, basically to hear their stories about how do you translate this child of yours into a universal output? Wow, that was technical, eh?
Output. No, I understand what you mean. It's definitely a weird task because I think both of us come from, at least, you know, songwriting is very organic, you know, in the way that we write songs all, you know, together as a band. So we only know the songs, you know, as a like sort of a live version or like as a rehearsal version. So sometimes it's hard to imagine what a sound, what a song sounds like translated or, you know, through a production, because then you can never really, if you're just writing the song while everyone, I think especially you with Seed, because you don't have like a big drum set or any instruments that really need to be amplified, you can probably just write a lot of your songs, you know, but just sitting around in your living room, right?
Yep, definitely in the living room, standing, lying down, doesn't really matter, yeah. But it's always done like that.
Yeah. So for us, that's not really we can't really do that because we have like the drums, which now more than on the first album play a more, you know, dominant, or, you know, now it's a drum set. On the first album it wasn't a drum set, so now it's more elaborate, and now we also have the electric bass and stuff like that. And when you have a drum set, you also need to amplify the vocals because you can't really hear, and the harp, for example, because you can't really hear the vocals over the drums. So when we went out writing songs last autumn, we had a living room. We rented like a house in the mountains, you know, whatever qualifies as mountains in in this area where we are. And we had a living room, but it was sort of like transformed into like a small, you know, we put up speakers and then an electric drum set and the mixing desk, and so that we could you know, record and even like hear what everyone was doing. So that was took something away from like the very organic, you know, just sitting around and playing music with your friends. But I actually like it because it puts me in a more focused mode, sort of. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes I'd also love it to not hassle with all of that stuff.
Yeah, there's definitely, if you have that, you sort of have to create how do I say it? I was going to use the word artificial balance. That sounded negative, but it's not meant as such, because it is an artificial balance where you have one loud instrument and you try to get the harp up to the same level. So, okay. So yeah, that's definitely way more tricky to get that going. And I think that sort of touches on the whole subject of recording all everybody separately in the studio is interesting, because all those I presume we have a lot of listeners that didn't go through the whole recording thing, so I'm starting at the super basic. You want to get a super clear signal of the instrument being played. So you can do with it what you want, edit the levels, balance, whatever. So you sort of rip the instrument from the whole, yeah, the whole, not being the H-O-L-E, but the W-H-O, from the whole. And it creates a completely different process and it just changes everything, because you're not at that moment necessarily a band. You could basically all be hired musicians that know what notes should be played. So I don't know, it's very it's always this whole recording these songs has always been a tricky process that people are probably noticing with the way I speak right now. It's difficult to do that. It's difficult to be at peace with that. For me, I'm just speaking personally, of course. But trying to get that band feeling in a studio while basically ripping the song or the roles apart. And yes, there are options to do it together, but that's a different chapter entirely. So I don't know where I'm going with this. I'm sort of feeling for you, like, man, having drums and then having to amplify stuff and then having to go through that. And then I was like, wow, I'm flashing back to the recording, and then, oh God, how do we record this acoustically, make it sound like it can be done by the campfire, but it's not. Basically, you should have started with that. You're going into the studio, which is all technical and electrical, and you're going to record a band that you want to make sound like it's done by a campfire and it has a festival feel, but you're not. That's where
amazing.
I'm just
happy I was here for, wow, you know, to be there with you on that, on, yeah, that ride to a sort of realization.
It was a, yeah, personal journey, definitely.
I was listening, and I was mesmerized, really. No, but interesting. I think we've talked about that in the past, but I think we've probably got a little bit of different approaches there, because I kind of love, you know, I really like being able to. So maybe we should explain for a second. There is.
Yeah, maybe start, yeah, at the basic, like, you enter a studio, so, what the fuck happens? You get coffee.
Basically, I think what Kuhn was describing, that, you know, the, I guess for most bands in our genre, whatever, the recording is going to be, like, recording through overdubs, which means that you record every instrument after another. So you record the drums first, and then the next instrument plays to the recording of the drums. And then the next person, the next musician plays to the two recorded instruments. And so you add onto the song instrument after instrument. So that is, I think, the, you know, maybe also just generally in today's music production, that is the way that most music is going to be produced and recorded. The other...
Yeah, and don't forget the metronome.
Oh yeah, there is also always a metronome, so that you can all be, you know, keep time and be like in the same speed and rhythm, which is very important. And the other way that, you know, usually I think was done back in the olden days, because you couldn't really do overdubs that easy, you know, just from a technical standpoint, is recording all the instruments together. You know, having the whole band stand in a big studio, maybe like separated by some like sound absorption walls, and then miking everyone, putting microphones in front of everyone individually, and then recording the band playing the song together. I think that's still being done, actually, for like, I think it's often done for like jazz and like and rock. That's what I can think of right now, where I know that it's been done like that. But I don't think it's really. I wouldn't know, at least, if there's like major like folk or folk rock or pagan folk bands that have gone that route. Maybe you're if you're out there and you've done it that way, you know, feel free to correct me. But yeah, basically, that's what we're talking about. And I actually really enjoy that process because I don't. To me, there's always a difference between how a song or a band sounds live and how it can sound on an album. And I think for us, that step sort of came with our second album, that we decided, you know, we can do things on an album that we can't reproduce live. And that's all right, because those are two different experiences. Now, of course, you still have to like transfer the soul of the song, and it still has to work in both versions, but they don't necessarily have to be exactly the same. So I think that might be like a point where our approach differs a bit.
Yeah. Interesting that you touch this subject, like what you said. You sort of what you said earlier, you have to sort of trust the sound engineer to do their it's basically their instrument, the table and all the technical stuff. I'm calling it technical stuff, I don't mean it degradingly, but it's just it's a lot of technical stuff if you look at like all the cables. Yes, that is very it's a cool thing, but it's also, to me, it's sort of like frightening, and I because it's like you're sailing in waters that you don't know, and that's not ultimately. When I started a pagan folk band, I was like, I want to play this music. And then afterwards, the shock came, okay, damn, we have to translate this. And we have some, like, my brother is very passionate about, he's a big metal fan, by the way, but so he loves his amplified stuff as well. But for this genre, for the folk and the pagan folk genre, he was always like, no, I've seen too many bands like stray from what made them great by using, or in maybe his words, abusing the studio too much, or wanting to make it work and sort of give it that extra oomph. He was always the guy that sort of, no, we're not doing that, we're not doing a 4-4 bam bam. But then again, we've learned a very valuable lesson that maybe you naturally learned. When you're playing live, especially in this not freaking especially in this genre, every live show has energy going around. When you're playing a CD in your living room as a listener, that energy's gone. So the band has to make sure that there's something that makes this the CD, the translation to the CD, worth listening to. And it isn't like, well, this is just a lesser version of what I get when it's live. No, it's an opportunity for the band to add in stuff that they can't add in live and that they maybe have to add in to make the CD worthwhile. And this is a lesson that's tricky for us, and that's just for us as persons, I think. And I think we're definitely growing in that, and that's also giving more leeway to the sound technician as a musician on his tables. So I think you might have had like sort of a head start there, maybe enjoying that whole process a bit more while we were resisting it.
I mean, I'm not sure if enjoying is necessarily the best term for it, but I agree. You know, I think you really hit it on the on the nail, hit it on the head, whatever. When you know the
we hit the nail on the head.
Oh yeah, Nicholas. All right, that makes sense, I guess. So basically, that you can't translate the life energy by just playing the pure thing, you know, because the it's just the context is different, and I think that's something that we definitely understood. And I think it also it's also fun to come up with like additional stuff that you can put onto a song. It's just because you can't do that. You can't really play two bouzouki melodies at the same time when you're playing live, but in the studio you can, and that's fun. But I think it's also it can also go sort of awry a bit. For example, something that we are still a little bit unhappy with is the vocal production on our second album is, you know, on some of the songs, to our tastes, it's way too clean. That's the thing. You have to trust your audio engineer, but you also have to find the right means of communication, you know, that you're talking, to be sure that you're talking sort of the same language. And also, you know, for the second album, also, we couldn't really find someone near to us who had experiences with like folk or, you know, let alone pagan folk music. So we went to someone who was more versed with like, I guess, you know, pop music for the most part. So when it came to editing the vocals, he made everything very edited, very clean, and every little, you know, crack in a voice or every little sort of hesitation that you put sometimes in a phrase to emphasize certain things or whatever, that sort of all got ironed out very strictly. And so it is a thin line that you walk when you want to use what the studio can offer you, basically. So I think there's probably like a good middle ground somewhere, but I think that's something to really strive for. And I wonder if there's like, I wonder if I can think of like an album where I think they really hit that balance. I mean, we talked about that album like two episodes ago when we did the episode about the Eden album by Faun, which I think is a very well produced album, but it doesn't feel, you know, clinical. I think it still sounds very organic. So that might be a good example for how to sort of balance that. And that's also an album where there's loads and loads of stuff on every song that you probably can't reproduce live. Although, now that I say it out loud, they can, because they have someone with a laptop who can just play the backing tracks. Nice.
Yeah, he plays the laptop. I mean, that's great. Then again, Nicholas, I think it's fairly important to stress the fact that they were formed in like 1998. So it was like Eden being like a culmination of many, many adventures or misadventures that we were sort of describing
earlier.
Oh
no, of course.
So we'll definitely be getting there. Yeah, I think that's the eternal search to translate. And I think like where you sort of hit the right subject is making your and here I think I can actually say it. In this genre, in this pagan folk genre, we're all using acoustic or a lot of acoustic instruments. They have their own personalities. They have their own imperfection. The person that handles the instrument brings in more perfections or maybe imperfections. But they need to be in there to be what it was made to be. And there's a lot of power in the technical aspect of recording an album where that can just be swooshed away with the twist of a button or the slider on a screen of a PC or Mac, whatever. So it's interesting. So that sort of search for the perfect sound technician or the it ideally you want it to be one of your band members that plays the laptop, basically.
Well, yeah, and I guess in a perfect world.
Yeah. Neil? Hello? No. Just...
No, yeah. Have you ever, have you ever thought about, you know, expanding your life sound I forgot the term. With like tracks that you can play. What's the word? Backing tracks.
Backing tracks.
Yes. Probably from just by knowing Lars through what you've been talking about so far, he's probably very adverse to that idea, right?
So I think there's a big difference to like intro tracks playing before you get on, but like backing tracks during the songs, like adding in new lines or soundscapes, I think that's going to be big no for the time being, because it's just something that we won't be able to deliver around a campfire. I mean, we can, let's just roll in the amps and the freaking gas, I don't know the English word, aggregaat, and just let it play. No, so And I don't know that it's not weird to have like a live set and a stage set and a campfire set, but for now, I think our main inspirations come from bands that don't have it. Like the reason why we started this, they don't, those bands didn't have it, and we loved it, so we don't feel like we're missing it. No. The only moment that we miss it, if you're going to be like, maybe a bigger audience would like it. That's like the moment that I would maybe be slipping. I don't know. It's tricky. I don't know. It's a tricky question, Niklas.
And I think actually, now that I think about it, I think we might have already talked about that when we talked about the playing, you know, playing live. There was a segment where we talked about how we feel about backing tracks and to what regard we use them.
But this is for the new listeners jump in at episode
10. This is episode 10. It's crazy.
Whoa! Anniversary?
Yeah, to a degree, I guess, yeah.
Here, let's drink a beer.
I don't even have one. It's sad.
Oh, wow.
I have
happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary to you too, babe. I just thought of a different thing that I think that it interests me is we talked, you know, talking about playing live, playing with guest musicians. Is there any guest musicians on any Seed album?
Yes.
Ooh, care to elaborate?
I can. Yes, so on the previous album we had my girlfriend, Chloe Bucker, the lovely Celtic harp player, on one of her songs called Seedling, and we also had Robin's girlfriend. So it's sort of an inbreeding thing, you know, but we love them. So who can blame us with her singing on various songs, including like great, something like a goosebumpy line or a bridge, really, in one of her songs, the gnome, the witch, and the tree. And we actually have our sound technician guesting on the album as well, with her accordion in The Hopcomer's Gift. So we were very... okay, guys, so everybody that's listening, I'm pretty sure our sound technician, who was a bit of a folk scene, still is, maybe. I have always had a huge crush on Fike, so that's why we went to her studio. And she also happened to be really good at sound engineering, so that's really good. So she plays on the album as well, so I don't know, I'm really happy about that. But yeah, it's a great addition to the song as well. She's one of those, I think I don't know if the band says like maybe we try a new sound engineer. She's really good. She feels like a part of the band when we're over there. So yes, we have some guests. Sorry, I elaborated. It's my love for Fiki, you know. And you?
Yeah, I think we share actually a guest musician in that regard because she also plays on our second album.
What?
Yeah. She plays hammered dulcimer in a song that's called Baba Yaga. And then she also recorded the cello that was played by Sophie from Kieser, who you can hear, you know, also on the same track and then also on a different track. I think with our second album, we went a bit like, we also have like the nickel harpa player and singer Jule Bauer from the German band Tuskilian on a song. And then we have like a remix by Neil Mitra. So we went all out with like, ooh, what can we do? You know, and I just wonder, you know, how do you feel about sort of like guest musicians, just, you know, generally speaking? Because I always think it's very cool if you can think of a cool musician that you also, you know, like personally, and then have them contribute to your music. I always really enjoy that. But I also think there is definitely a point that could be made for it being a bit, you know, redundant. Like, ooh, can't you do the music on your own? Do you need help from like outsiders to do it in a cool way? And because, you know, sometimes I think I'm not gonna like call any names or anything. I can't even think of someone right at this moment. But I think there's definitely also sometimes, especially like in bigger pop or like rock and metal bands, where sometimes you have a guest contribution just for the fame, you know, where you sort of try to boost your sort of like your song, your album.
The featuring thing on there, exactly. And then the hurrah. Well, for me personally, but I think I'm like I'm horrible at commercial stuff, not because I'm super against it, just because I'm super bad at it. The way we go about that would be thinking, or ideally, it would be thinking, what instrument do we want? Do we know someone that's close to our heart that can probably share the energy that we put into this music, that we can sort of communicate that to? And if you sort of transcend that and then don't care about whether they understand your music, I think then you could possibly get close to making the decision because you just want the extra exposure, or otherwise you're just like, no, I really hear this like contrabass, we need this, and it doesn't really matter who does it, I just need this in my song, we don't have anyone. So then it serves the song. But then again, if you look at what we've done with this album, is we don't have a harp. I have a girlfriend that plays the harp. She's really good at it. She really likes the song, and then it just sort of adds up, and the whole experience makes sense. The same goes for when Fika played. We were like, Fika, sorry, but we would love for you to play on our album, but whatever you feel most. So then it's like, okay, personally I would say like I like the hurdy-gurdy a lot. Would I choose accordion? No. Fika said this is the instrument closest to my heart, so I would love to play this, and I think I hear myself playing it on this song. So then it's completely different. It's just you creating like a personal story in the album without serving a featuring or something you already heard. Oh, this is really missing. I think there's different journeys, and yes, there's loads of people using the featuring. I mean, we're going for next album. We're going featuring Timbaland. We're in. I mean, he's just going to do. We're in. man. But yeah, I definitely have musicians on my bucket list as well. So it's also a personal thing, I think.
Ooh, yeah. I also have some people that I'd really love to, you know, to have contribute something to our music. But then again, I say yes.
I can't say no to you. That's
okay. Well, I'm unfortunately, I think no.
No. This is embarrassing. Cut.
No. Yeah, but I also, I don't know, I'm always a bit conflicted about it because I also think it's, you know, for our, you know, when we asked for our last album, we asked Neil if he wanted to contribute a, you know, a remix. Of course, we wanted to do that because we are, you know, we're fans of his music. But of course, you know, when you buy our album, there is a sticker on the outside where it says featuring guest appearances by. So, you know, of course, we do use it to advertise because, you know, you need, you know, as a small band, you sort of need to try to, like, you know, get yourself out there, you know, and that didn't feel too dirty. It's just telling what's on the inside.
It wasn't a super weird person to be involved in the album.
No, true. I mean,
it's a featuring, like, what is that? Featuring Timbaland. It's like, wait, what? Who knows who? Who gave who a blowjob, basically? But in this case, it makes perfect sense. And then, yes, this is how, when I was in my emo period, whoa, that sounds very strange. When I was into post-hardcore music, I knew certain bands and I was looking for others and they had stickers on it, like sounds like Escape the Fate or Bless the Fall. And then I would listen to the band, which I otherwise would not have found. So it's actually a good way to sort of broaden your horizon. So no, it's, yeah. I think people that do it know what the goal is. Yeah. And it's all good.
Yeah. So, I think we've talked about that you are not, like, you're not super into recording at a studio is what I've gathered so far. There are certain aspects that, I mean, I guess, you know, that make you a bit anxious, a bit nervous. I feel the same about certain aspects. But is there, like, a favorite aspect of recording an album that you really like? You know, either be it the recording itself, or then, you know, listening to the first mixes, or, you know, then having the masters, or, you know, writing little notes on what you want to sound different. Is there, like, a certain aspect or a certain moment that you really, really enjoy?
Yeah, for us, it's definitely because up until now, we've made it a big point, and we're going to break that vow, sadly, this week. Wait, maybe that... Yeah. Is that we always are there together, so we have fun being there together and supporting each other. I hate being up there alone in the studio. And then again, I really love, because we are there together, is when we sit on the couch and the boxes go on with what we recorded, what had the good sound technician have, like, this quick editing that just goes on while you're talking. Like, I'm going to the loo, and they're like, whoo, 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 whoo. And it already sounds like pretty good. Like, the first mix where everything is sort of connecting, that makes me cry every time. Yeah. So that is something that can't be recreate it anywhere else. So yeah, the listening back to the first mixes, what you like you said.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. Actually, for this production that we're doing, I mean, I guess right now it's a bit different because this is the first time that we're doing, like, extensive pre-production, Our drummer has like programmed electric drums so that we can have as a guide, and then everyone has played their stuff in an overdub style. So on my computer now I have like sort of like refined pre-production demo tracks, and then I've also, even though like I'm at no by no means like a skilled audio engineer, but I've been doing what I can with my limited knowledge and resources, and I've been able to coax out some pretty okay sounding stuff. And so it's very exciting to sort of like go to that place that you've been talking about, and like being able to listen to like the first realized version of a song. So now and because I like a lot of what we like a lot of what we're hearing, it's now even more exciting to go into an actual studio with like a person who actually knows what they're doing, and to sort of do it again. And then I'm excited to compare like what I've been doing to like then the actual finished song, because it's gonna be like a whole world of a difference. I'm very excited about that, and I think that also might be my favorite moment. You know, having that moment of like, oh shit, it's actually a song. Because while you're playing it, you can, at least I can't really ever step out of it, you know, and listen to it. But when you hear it in a recorded form, you're like, oh shit, it's actually a song. And you don't hear like all the individual parts that make it up, but you hear it as a whole unit. And that's something that's very, very magical, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I'm allergic to just hearing me play through an amplified mic and hearing my, as a flute player, I was, and it's by the way, I was going to diverge back to like, should the engineer remove that in its entirety? I think we've sort of skilled over the whole thing, and how for the people listening, this was the basic episode version. I mean, we can talk about everything we've brushed over for way longer, but this is, I think that's why maybe some listeners are like, okay, cool, yeah, this is what the guy from Seed experiences, this is what the guy from Wild Cows experiences, but it's not like we're trying to do our vocal biographies here. It's more like trying to sort of communicate what goes into presenting the music genre that we are playing. And a lot of great bands that you and I enjoy together. So I hope we sort of gave a good impression of how complicated it is to, well, basically translate a drawing into a 3D picture.
Oh, that's a good way of phrasing it. Also, I had set up the perfect transition to do like a shout out, but then I missed my window. So do you mind real quick?
I super do not mind.
Okay, so while talking about guest appearances earlier, I was going to mention that you, my friend Kuhn, have like a guest appearance on an upcoming release. Isn't that right?
I don't remember. I drink a lot. No, that's not actually funny to joke about, Kuhn. Yes, I have guested on an album, and I'm very proud, because, yes, it sounds very sad because they don't get asked a lot. So I was super thrilled. Just to get asked anyway, I mean, that's cool in itself. I mean, someone else is like, oh, I hear something. Who can translate this to my music, which is very personal? And then it was also a very cool guy with a very cool project. So 1 + 1 = 9. And then I was like, yes, I say yes. And then I went to the studio, also my favorite studio, with Fike, with... Tim Elfring from bands like Paralysis, Imbue, and now also his lately revealed band Right Eye. No, I'm just kidding. It's Left Eye. Because him and I think the drummer, if I heard correctly, are left-handed. And it's like, I'm just going to give it a genre call. Shoot me if I'm wrong. Prog rock folk mix up. And I'm playing the Fujara, the huge Hungarian overtone flute on one of his songs, which hasn't been released yet, and it's super exciting and badass.
Yeah, so, yeah, as you said, the project is called Left Eye, and they have a EP coming out, you know, today's Thursday, so they have the EP out tomorrow on June 26th, the Long Road EP, and you should all definitely check it out and see what someone from the folk genre, what other different musical styles they venture into sometimes. Good stuff. So yeah, I think we're sort of like coming around to the end of the topic. Yeah, and of course, as Kuhn rightfully said, it's just a glance at everything that goes into it. It's, I feel like these conversations are more sort of detailing our different experiences with things, you know, which is, I guess, it's the most honest thing that we can do. So I really like that. I hope you people listening are also taking some enjoyment from it. I'm actually gonna say that we're gonna record a third episode of about this topic, because we I'd also love to hear your opinions on your opinions on, like, you know, the whole releasing and release concerts and promotion and, you know, all of that different stuff, because that's also a very significant part, I think. Maybe we can also talk a bit about, you know, artwork and pressing an actual CD and stuff like that, because that's also, I think, as bands who are mostly DIY, that's something that we know some things about, maybe, so that'd be interesting. So I'm gonna propose that we're gonna do a third episode about that. So if next week you hear a third episode about that, my wish had been fulfilled, or if Kuhn is super against it, it's just gonna be a different thing, but we're not gonna reveal it yet.
Yeah, this is actually the first time that I'm hearing about this, but I'm sort of, I'm liking the idea, and then sort of like hoping that, I don't really know what our audience is, because we do this because we love this and we want to sort of project our love. But I think if I think back, I would have loved to have like a podcast of some do-it-yourself pagan folk musician talking about what will probably happen and what will be the obstacles in your way. And I think artwork, release, pressing, promoting, which all sounds very dry and bland, but it doesn't have to be, which you will find out in next week's episode. I hope we have inspired or helped out at least one person still doubting whether they should start a pagan folk band. Or maybe someone who's just started out. I like it, Niklas. I like it.
All right. I like it a lot. So it's settled then. Cool. But yes. Of course, we can't finish this episode without some new additions to the playlist.
Recommendations.
Yeah, I think I've been a bit sloppy with updating the playlist, but I did it earlier today, so I think now it should have... It should include every song that we've talked about the last two episodes. And I'm going to add the new songs right away so that I won't forget it. So sorry for I've been getting like one or two messages of people who were like, oh, you're not updating the playlist. And yes, now I did. I'm sorry.
Really?
Yeah, but I mean, that's okay.
Very good. Yeah. Keep them sharp, guys. Send them more.
So
only two.
I'm gonna go ahead with my first pick and sort of do
nice.
And sort of do like a second shout out for a release, for a band who released a new album quite frequently. I think it was released, last Friday, and that band is, I don't know if they've actually ever played Kasselfest, but if they haven't, they definitely should, but I think they have. That is the wonderful Hungarian band, The Moon and the Night Spirit.
They definitely have. They definitely have. And thank the gods they have played. I hope they will come back.
Yes. So they released a new album last Friday, which is called Ether. And, oh, sorry. My song is my voice. The song that I choose is just the first track of that album, because a lot of other songs by them have Hungarian names, and I can't pronounce them. So I'm just gonna choose the first song off that album, which is called Ether, of the album Ether by The Moon and the Night Spirit.
Nice. I love them, and I follow them. I think I saw them the first time at Kasselfest when I first saw them. It wasn't their first gig, but that's when I first saw them. And if there is one band that really brings out artwork, their violinist and a vocal, and I think she actually also plays the flute on the albums. I've never seen her play it live. She creates the best artwork. And no, we don't get endorsed, but we just love this and we like spreading the love for this. I think they also have like LPs, which are completely making a comeback. I'm just looking at the artwork right now. And they're great. The artwork is great. And now I'm skedaddling over to my first recommendation, which is actually a band that is not really releasing anything anymore, but it's still a very fond musical memory and something I listen to from time to time. And it's L'Homme de Phoque. And it's a Valencian band composing music based on like folklore from Mediterranean and medieval Middle Eastern influences. And they have great traditional instruments, and the singing is out of this world, something that my Dutch mind can't really, I can't see our yeah, it's very old, you know. I would like to say like, oh, I can't see our Dutch ladies bringing so much passion into their singing, but I don't know if I can. But L'Homme de Phoque, and then the song I would like to recommend is Morena, but we're doing a Spotify playlist, so look that one up on YouTube, and we'll add another one in that is just as good on the Spotify playlist. But I didn't want to withhold Morena from you.
So which song are you... you're going to just tell me which song to add instead, okay? You're going to write me that? Okay.
Yeah, so people look up Morena on YouTube, and then they are on Spotify, and they're like, wow, this song is great as well. Wow. Two for the prize.
So my second pick is, I hope it's not too far out for our playlist, but I've definitely heard music like that being played on Kasselfest, and it's something that has been sort of creeping into my mind lately, because it's... a song that has been on our sort of like band van playlist for some time, and it's a very energetic song, and it's by the American band The Klezmatics, which is a sort of a band that mixes, you know, klezmer music, which is the traditional music of sort of like Eastern European Jewish people. You know, and they mix that with ska and rock and some other influences. And the song that I'm choosing is called Der Gela Fink, which is a very wild instrumental song. And if it's, it's incredible. It will give you some good energetic vibes, I hope. It's a lovely song.
Well, I totally feel like the mainstream pagan folk dude when I hear your recommendation. Like, whoa, man, this dude's bringing in the underground stuff, but I don't know, it might just be me. I feel like I'm catering to the maybe more easier to the ears Kasselfest audience, and you hit me with the Klezmatics, and I'm like, damn, man, I'm not trying hard enough. I should delve deeper.
Well, I think Lambda Fuck is a pretty, like, a deep dive, I think. They're one of the, they're some of, like, the OGs of that type of music, I think. Isn't that, like, didn't Efren Lopez used to play in that band?
When you actually look at this video, La Morena on YouTube, it says Lambda Fuck / Efren Lopez. So, yeah.
I'm a big fan of him, he's an incredible musician.
Yeah, yeah, and there, and then, huzzah, you will reach his YouTube channel, you'll find more awesome stuff, so huzzah.
Huzzah, yeah, indeed.
The internet can be very good. Okay, my next one is actually from a band that doesn't really, at the moment, I think, create anymore, sadly. It's from a guy that through the internet I got connected with. His name is Nikola Petrov, and now he made a great game as well. The greatest bard of all. And he played in a folk project. I'm calling it a project because it's not really got any momentum at this moment. And it is on Spotify, actually. And it is Erine. And the song is called The Golden Apple. And it's sort of like, if you like Irfan, you will love this as well. If you don't like Irfan, you'll probably love this as well, because it's just great.
I think very, very Eastern European are our recommendations this time. I love it. It's a very, yes. I think maybe not for a lot of people, but it's definitely, I think, in a lot of untapped potential in that sort of musical region. So I'm excited. Maybe if you, dear listener, know some cool bands out of that sort of like musical realm, feel free to hit us up. We're always excited to listen to new mystical folk music, whatever you you think would fit that description. But yeah.
And or if you know a festival that we could play it, that would be cool. I want to play there.
I remember last year, our good friends from the band Brisinga were booked for a festival in, I think it might have been just Hungary, and the pictures from there were so gorgeous. I was very, very jealous. So you know, if you know someone, hit us up. Because we want to go to all the places. if that's you know, when that is,
we'll record an episode from there. It's a game.
I love that. So honestly, I think my dream with this podcast is one day to do like a live podcast in front of an audience. I'd love that.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Well, we can dream big. We'll get there. No probs. No props, because we have an amazing audience and they'll get those there, so that's good.
All right, so thank you everyone for listening. We know that it's been we've sort of lost track a bit with our weekly uploads. There have been some issues that we that we encounter in these troubling times. So but we're trying to get back on track with releasing regularly. I really enjoy doing something, you know, every week. So I hope we can go back to this. But if not, don't be afraid. We're not going anywhere. It just might be delayed sometimes. We still love, you know, getting your feedback. And if you know someone who you think would enjoy this podcast, feel free to share it. I think with this being our 10th episode, there is quite a nice backlog of episodes to dive into. Even if this is your first one to listen to, there is lots of interesting stuff in older episodes. Wow. So, check us out, share it with your friend, listen to the playlist, be nice to each other, you know, the usual things.
I have nothing to add. Love yourself. Love each other, make a difference by loving, and that's it. So
you goddamn hippie.
Yeah, this was Meat and Moonlight, the Pagan Folk
Podcast, episode 10.